we have 14 athletes and only 12 can make a team, or we have 7 athletes, 5 can go to a particular competition. How do we now decide how to choose, so how to compare between the athletes?
You know, it depends on the sport, but it's probably not a decision made on data. It's probably a decision made on skill of the athlete, right? So the coach will probably make that. It doesn't matter whether, you know, one athlete can jump 3 centimeters higher than the other, and the other physical capacity. You know, skill will always trump capacity, right? It's just that if you take a skillful athlete and you give them a great capacity, the chances are they're a better athlete, right? But it's never going to take a good athlete, give them the physical capacity, and now they're a great, outstanding athlete, you know? So those decisions are still based on skill.
Hi, Anthony. It's my pleasure to have you in Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Hey, Alex. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak on your show. So my name is Anthony Turner. I am professor in strength and conditioning at Middlesex University.
Awesome. Your work is mostly related to athletes of team sports, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, actually, I worked with British fencing, and that was a team sport as well as an individual sport. And I've worked with some other individual athletes in taekwondo, in different martial arts, but now predominantly, yeah, absolutely in team sport environments. And currently I work in football. I work with Tottenham in their girls academy as well, so I do some part-time work there as well.
All right, so that's to have a little bit of a background on you and I guess your expertise in the field. And we will be I invited you to talk about athlete profiling, so let's start with what it is and then we will go on to all the details.
yeah, no problem. I guess when we talk about trying to profile an athlete, we want to understand physical characteristics, certainly in the context that I'm talking about. And we want to understand their physical characteristics with respect to the demands of the sport that they play. Are they strong enough, fast enough? Do they have the aerobic capacity, repeat sprint ability, etc., to meet the demands of the sport? Or I guess it may be even more specifically, to meet technical or tactical demands of the head coach, right? Because a head coach might come in and suggest that the athletes need to play in a particular way. And so we need to build those athletes so that they can do that. And one of the ways we check our progress is we test them. And once we've got that data, we use that data to say, right, we've profiled this athlete with respect to physical characteristics. And this is where they are. And this is where they need to get to. Or, you know, but each different discipline will have its own profile. You know, the physios, the psychology team, the nutrition team will also profile the athlete. So I guess collectively, that's when it's most powerful, when you're getting these different viewpoints that holistically describe the profile or the state of the athlete relative to what they're expected to do.
All right. So should we discuss why we should do it, or maybe why we shouldn't do it? What are the pros and cons?
Yeah, I think that the pros. So firstly, right, we don't want to guess that they have a particular capacity to do it, because we might be wrong, right? And sometimes things look like, oh, they're great, they can definitely do this, and actually turns out they can't, or vice versa. So it takes the guesswork away. Equally, it helps us reflect on the journey that we're taking the athlete on, like what's working really well and what's not working. And it helps us highlight where the biggest windows of opportunities are, right? It's great, we want to say to the athlete, well done, you're really strong here, but what I'm really interested in is where they're weakest, because that's where the low-hanging fruit is, right? And we just do always just go for the low hanging fruit. What's the biggest window of opportunity? And so when we do that, we get an opportunity to zero in on what needs to be trained. Equally, it enables us to make comparisons across athletes, equally comparisons within different positions within a team, different weight classes as well. So I think there's lots of good reasons to do it, but I think sometimes we can overdo it, because, you know, every time you test someone, you take away a training opportunity. And equally, we have to recognize, I'm sure we'll get into this, that, you know, sometimes when you collect the data, you still need to make a judgment on that data, and that judgment as to whether they got better, got worse, is based on how you analyze it and the beliefs you have around what's classed as real and what's not. And so there's still the opportunity there to actually make some errors, you know, to suggest that someone needs to train a particular capacity when they don't, or that they've got weaker when they haven't, or stronger when they haven't, and so on. So it can also, if you don't think about it appropriately, it can confuse the issue, you know. And at that point, you might as well go back to the coach's eye. And there's some coaches out there who have a finely trained coach's eye, and for the most part, what they see, they're absolutely right. Their intuition is correct. So I think the data is fantastic, but we need to understand how to use it if we're going to appropriately and successfully profile an athlete. And the tests need to be appropriate as well. We need to understand that sometimes we're just testing the same thing, but in a different disguise, right? And this again is when testing gets away from us and it ends up being counterproductive. So as long as you know how to analyze the data appropriately, as long as you're not fooled by different tests measuring the same thing and you don't overdo it, then I think it's a really powerful tool to help with your programming moving forward to be reflective of the efficacy of your program.
Okay, so let's go into decision making. So let's say we decided, oh yeah, we would like to test our athletes. How you would go about starting? And please feel free to use examples. Where to start?
Yeah, so where to start? And this is the thing with all with data, right? And any form of analysis is, whilst you think that the answers to this should be very, you know, binary, very black and white, there's only one way to do it. It's anything but. Okay, so this would be my approach to do it. And anyone might have a different approach, but that's okay, as long as it's justified, well-reasoned, and you stick with that as you move forward. You don't change your tack because you're not finding what you want to find. And I'm sure, again, we'll get into that. But so in terms of what to test, so you want to understand the sport first and foremost. What are the key performance indicators of the sport? And also importantly is, what does the coach want from the athlete? Remember, there's how to play the sport, and then there's how to play the sport the way that the coach wants. So you might sit down with a coach and go, right, what does a good athlete look like? And what can they do? What do you need them to do? We need them to be able to win tackles, to cover distance, to be able to change direction, to move fast, sprint, so on and so forth. And every time they're saying something, I'm writing that down, these key performance indicators, right? These KPIs. Fantastic. So now I've got roughly the physical characteristics that you deem as important. The next level then is, I would start to think, well, how do I test these things? And what ones are roughly the same thing? Now, so then I've come down to the next level. This is how I test strength. This is how I test power. These are the different options to test power, different options to test speed. You know, which one's most appropriate given the sport? And then once we have that layer of what to test, the layer underneath is about, well, how do we train it? And this to me is the beauty of it, because if I know that a particular test maps back to capacity, then my job as someone in charge of physical performance is to improve that capacity, and I demonstrate that improvement by then getting better at the test. So another reason why we test is that I now have accountability in my role. Now I should be making you better at those tests, which then mean that I deliver the coach and athlete that can perform on the field the way that they need them to. And the way that I then improve that capacity is I understand the different characteristics that make up that test score. So now I almost have my training journey, my roadmap that I now start to plan from. So that's how I would start to identify the tests. The next thing is, maybe it's not clear what tests are most appropriate. You know, there's 10 ways to test strength, power, speed, and so on and so forth. So maybe you're going to choose one that's most similar to the sport, or maybe you just, to understand where things are similar and things are dissimilar, is you start to look at the relationships between those data, and you quickly start to figure out actually some of them are just doing the same thing. So which one I choose is which one either biomechanically looks the most similar, the athletes prefer doing, I have the logistics to do it, takes less time. Most importantly, it's most sensitive to change, it's most reliable to use. And those are the things that really inform the best testing batteries as I see it.
Would you take into account the variability of the particular test results?
Always. I mean, this is paramount. This is absolutely paramount. You don't know whether someone's changed, or you don't know how you can infer whether someone's got better or not, unless you understand the variability of the test and the variability of the person. I mean, I guess, okay, to try to give an example. So if you go to the gym, right, and you lift 17 kilos on the bench press, let's just say you lift 70. Then you go 2 days later within the same week and you lift 72 kilos, right? And then 2 days later, you go again and you lift 69 kilos, right? Do you think, how do you explain that? Have I got stronger and then got weaker within the space of 4 days? You know, or is there some other reason to explain that? Now, when you put it like that, people actually go, okay, yeah, maybe there hasn't been a long-term change, a structural change in my neuromuscular system. There can't be, because I got stronger then I got weaker. And like, absolutely, there can't be. What you're looking at there is human variability, which we're all subject to. So why did I go from 70 to 72? Do you know what? On that day, maybe you had a great night's sleep, you ate well, and life was rosy, it was sunny outside. What happened on a 69? Well, this is life. You didn't get a lot of sleep, you ate bad, you had an argument at home, work was terrible, and it's pouring of rain, you're in a bad mood, you're not motivated. This is human variability is the first thing we need to account for. If we don't account for human variability, and you're the coach and you're high five, we got better, we put 2 kilos on, the next day, like, oh, they got worse. You're the worst coach. You're best coach, worst coach, best coach, worst coach. Because you constantly flip-flop through, you claim every change to be real when it's just variability. You've got as much chance of being the best coach as you do the worst coach. So firstly, we need that variability to protect you. Right, but if I take that example, there's not much variability from the human, but let's go another example now. And if we take the variability in, let's say you weigh yourself every morning, all right, and you do that, over consecutive days. So nothing's changed. You know, your weight's going to fluctuate, right? Some days you're going to weigh more than other days and weigh less than other days. But now we've got human variability because you're weighing yourself maybe at different times of the day. You're not doing it first thing in the morning. You're wearing different things. You're eating different things. Maybe you're not doing it fasted. Also, you've got measurement error now. Now we've got a second cause of error. And that second cause of error is the device. That's only so accurate as well. So we couple this. So now to stop this person having a meltdown from gaining weight and then losing weight, we go, we have to count the variability, right? That variability means that until you score outside of it, you've neither got better nor worse. And it's that, again, it's that protection for your own sanity and you as a coach to stop you claiming something that's real that isn't, because it gets you as, you know, it will get you sacked as much as it will get you promoted, to be honest. And then another example will be if you're doing speed testing, right? So you've got the variability of the person, sleep, diet, so on and so forth, how their day was, how life is at home. You got the kit, the timing gates, the test setup. And then you've got the environment. Is it hot? Is it cold? What's the surface like? You see, all of this variability adds in. And when you start to appreciate that variability, you get to understand that any score that an athlete gets is just an average of the scores that they could have got. They could have scored higher or they could have scored lower at that moment in time, because you've got human variability, device variability, and environmental variability. You know, sometimes people are cheering you on and sometimes your enemy's in there or someone you try to impress is in the crowd. And so all of that makes a big difference. So when you compute all of that, which must be done, you end up in a safer zone where you can say, yep, they got better and they got worse. And it's how we calculate that, which is the important thing. So I hope that made, I think I went on a bit there, but I hope that made sense.
No, the examples were amazing. Now I want to know how you calculate what is that window within which you want to not claim fame.
Yeah. Look, I think the simple, and it's beautiful because it is so simple, is the standard deviation, right? So you take an athlete's score. If we take the, you take the weighing scale one. You know, so let's say you go into the shops, you want to buy some weighing scales. So what you should do is stand on this, you know, you can't decide weighing scale A or weighing scale B. So you stand on weighing scale A 5 times and weighing scale B 5 times. You record all the scores down. They're probably not going to be the same. Well, for this example, let's assume they're not going to be the same, and it's very unlikely that they are. And what you do then, you've got the scores. Now you might go, what's the average? And the average of the scores might be exactly the same. So you're like, that doesn't help. But if I now look at the variance, how varied the scores are from the mean, that's very informative. That's the standard deviation. Because if you find that the standard deviation is very high, it means the scores are quite dispersed. They're quite far from the mean. If the standard deviation is very small, it means they're quite nicely clustered around the mean. Because in that example, we weighed ourselves 5 times. If you imagine we only weigh ourselves once, right? So you go there and you weigh yourself once. And if these are the 5 scores I could get, and this might be really clustered, it's just luck of the draw. I could have weighed myself and got this data point. Or I could have weighed myself and got this data point, which is less. And I've been really happy. It's just luck. But now if I had a much more closer, now actually when I weigh myself, maybe at worst, I get this one or this one. But now I'm more sensitive to change, because you see, for me to claim something as real, I need to fall outside of this data range. Whereas on the other one, I've got to fall outside of much, much wider intervals. So this one is far less sensitive than this one, even though the mean is the same. So the standard deviation, therefore, is our way to detect that. And so if I was doing anything else, if I was doing jumps, for example, and like, let's just go jump height. So like, do your jumps. What's your standard deviation of the jump height? Okay, it's 3 centimeters, 2 centimeters, wherever it is. Okay, for you to improve, we know you need to jump outside of 3 centimeters, okay? And then we can claim that as real because your variability. And what will happen with time, people get better at testing. They are more familiar with the test. The weighing example, they learn over time that they have to weigh themselves the same time in the morning after they've been to the toilet, not eating, whatever it is. Then what you start to see is the standard deviations start to come down. So everything in control of the environment or the human we can control, the device we cannot control, and that's on you to check the device before you buy it. If you're in a weighing scale and you're getting that one, don't buy it. You know, go for the one that's like that. You set yourself up to fail. There's only so much you can improve. So for sure, the standard deviation, I think, is the easiest way to do it. And the good thing with the standard deviation is it's in the units, right? So if the jumps are 40 centimeters and the standard deviation is 3 centimeters, well, then the standard deviation is 3 centimeters. You know how much you've got to change. Because the other way is a coefficient of variation, which we use in research, which is percentage. So it's a relative dispersion around the mean. But then if you go, all right, so let's say the coefficient of variation, the variability of the test is 4%. Yeah, all right, cool, so it's 4%. But what is 4%? How do I know if I've got proved? Okay, so what we need to do is reverse engineer how we calculate the coefficient of variation and to get into the same units, and those same units happen to be the standard deviation. So the standard deviation is perfect. It's absolutely perfect way of doing it.
So you mentioned one important thing, that controlling how you measure is narrowing down standard deviation. So narrowing down the variability within the outcomes or the measurements you are getting. Are there any other ways to do it?
There's variability in every single one of them, no matter what you do. You'll never, ever avoid it. The mistake is to not factor it in, is to assume it doesn't exist. That's the only mistake that you can make. So in terms of controlling it, have people cheering or don't cheer. You know, choose one and go with it. It's probably easier to not have people cheering, because how do you control the quality of the cheer?
Yeah.
You know, like that. And it's the, you know, it's like you say, the force plates or the testing kit or the weighing scale. It's got to be in the same position. Different parts of the floor might move more or be imbalanced. All of this, I think, is important, but it's impossible to alleviate that variability. It's impossible. You do the best job you can to control it. If you think about every test, it's basically a signal to noise ratio, right? And if you want to measure as much of that signal as you can, you get the noise down, which let's say is a standard deviation. And so you need the tester to know exactly what they're doing to administer it the same. You know, a good example would be coaching cues. Here's another one. We know that if how I tell you to jump on a force plate will change the result, right? So imagine we've control for everything, but I put a new tester in there for my athlete, and the coach or the tester, sorry, says something like, you know, jump as high as you can, right? But the next person says, jump as fast as you can. You know, so they're different scores now. I mean, actually, the height could be similar, but the strategy which people are more interested in looking at is going to be wildly different. You know, same as drop jumps, you know, land quietly, land fast, so on and so forth. Go for height, the instruction you give. So probably the coaching cues is another layer to add to that, which will change the outcome to some degree, but will have a huge effect on the strategy, the process by which that outcome is achieved. So I'll say that's important as well.
Awesome.
And sorry, I'll say one other point as well. We can't control it all. So if you're in an environment where you're sometimes going to test in the morning and sometimes test in the evening, that's it. So be it. It's, you know, if that's out of your control, that's out of your control, different testers. It just means your noise will be more. But it's okay. There's only so much you can do. Recognize it and build it into your test. That's all you've got to do. You know, everyone's got to do their best, and part of that is recognizing your own variability in your own lab. And that's why I see sometimes research papers, you know, or when I do research, we report our own reliability, because I know that jumping has had its own reliability reported in other papers in other labs, but that's their reliability. Ours might be better or worse, and we need to declare that when people read our papers. So choose your own reliability. It would constantly change every single time you do it. Always do multiple trials.
All right, multiple trials. That's another point. I think, yeah, that's the way to. Okay, what what variability is too much variability? So at what point it is still acceptable? At what point it is, no, this is rubbing data, we know nothing?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I guess it's trying to avoid lines in the sand to go that this number means it can't be used. But clearly, the higher the number, the less able you can use it. So let's say, for example, we're doing a jump test. You know, jump is quite an easy one. And the variability is 10 centimeters. It's a silly example, but it creates it. There's no point to it. The person's never going to get better or never get worse, because how much training have you got to do to jump higher than 10 centimeters, right? And the same for weighing scale. If weighing scale's variability is 1 kilo, I mean, it's going to take forever before they see a change. So it needs to be considered with respect to the volume of increase or decrease you might expect to see. So as an example, for jumping, you'd like to be sensitive to about a centimeter, right? So if the variability is, you know, or 2 centimeters, if the variability is more than 2 centimeters or more than 3 centimeters, let's say, it's got to be conservative. I'm not sure it's that good. You know, you got to wait for a 3 centimeter improvement or decrease to go, you got better or worse. It's, you know, how many testing points have you done by that point? You know, people use testing to inform readiness to train, fatigue levels. That thing is not sensitive enough because it's only got 3 centimeters. It's only accurate within 3 centimeters either side of the score. So I think you have to consider what is and what isn't good relative to the amount of change you would expect within, let's say, you know, the jumping within at the end of a training block, you know, and equally the level that the athlete's at. So you might be able to get a newbie to jump more than 3 centimeters comfortably within the end of the first training block. But a good level athlete, you know, no, that's not going to happen. So I'd want it to be way more sensitive.
We discussed where to start, how to set up tests, what to pay attention to. Now we have some data collected. What do we do with it?
So again, you need multiple trials, right? So let's say, again, jumps. So you got your 3 jumps. We calculate the standard deviation from that, which is very easy to do in Excel. And then what we do with the score is we build our, say, confidence intervals around that, or could even call it compatibility intervals. Because, you know, if we say that the jump was 40 centimeters and the standard deviation was 2 centimeters, then really it could have been anywhere between 38 and 42 centimeters, the jump, right? So all data within here, within this range, is compatible with what the athlete could have got, right? So we calculate the standard deviation. And then what we want to do then is add that standard deviation onto their score to say, you need to jump more than this next time round, say that you've improved. Well, actually, there's a little bit more to it than that, because there's going to be error in the next test, right? So you need to account for error in the second test. So if you want to make a target that you can be confident falls outside the variability of the person, the test, the environment, coach, wherever it is, you might want 2 standard deviations. But if we have 2 test points, if we tested you at this time point and I've tested you at the second time point, then I already have that best data. So I haven't got to make a conservative estimate by doubling the standard deviation, for example. I've got this score and this standard deviation. So I've got these intervals, and I've got this score and this standard deviation, these intervals. What I would look for is if they don't overlap, I'll say that you got better. All right, so that's you got better. That's there's no change because there's overlap. And to go the other way, if they don't overlap, then you got worse. That's how I would start to use the standard deviation, or how I would compute those scores. I think another point I was going to say on there is that when you take jumps as an example, this is where the, you know, your own personal approach, philosophical approach comes into it. My approach would be, for the jumps, I would take the best score. I said, if you jumped 40, 41, 42, all right, I wouldn't report the mean, you know, 41. I would say you jumped 42 because you did. I literally watched you jump 42. So I would take the best score and build the standard deviation around the best score, right? And then I would do the same for the second, right? For the follow-up test. So I choose to use the best score and put the standard deviation around the best score. But the debate is, well, when do you use the average? Personally, I would use the mean if I'm describing anthropometry, height, mass, weight. And I would also use the mean if I was describing strategy-based metrics as well, because they can edit.
That's one, for example.
So if I'm looking at, let's say, you might report jump height as max, your strategy ones might be time to take off, braking force, propulsive force, depth, counter movement depth, you know, change in center of mass. So for those ones, I average would be the one, and your mass, your height would be average. But scores were us about a maximum output based performance metric, speed, well, speed will obviously be the lowest, but, you know, weightlifting, jumps, blood force, maximum force, peak force, things like that, I would go with the best score.
I think we're at this point that tracking is not as much of an issue as choosing is. So if we go with the jump, the measurement, if you do it on the force plate, for example, you have hundreds almost measures you can be looking at. And then the problem is in actually choosing which one is important and meaningful, because there's so many of them.
Exactly. I mean, actually, I think there's probably about 200 metrics that you get from a force plate now, the same for GPS units that they use. And I'm convinced that people must phone the software or the hardware company and say, look, this is, we'd really like to measure this. And they must, to some degree, have to go, yeah, let's do it. Sounds pretty cool. Let's go for it. But they end up producing a metric that's just crazy variable, right? And it sounds cool. Remember, it has biological feasibility. Directly, it's good, but in practice, it just doesn't work. And there are tons of them there, just crazy amounts of them. And so we have to be able to differentiate from them, you know? And actually, some are good, but they're all just a different disguise of the same metric. So you'll see on some of the different software providers that you can just scroll down and look at the variability. They might report it as coefficient of variation, right? And you'll see some of that 30%, 40%, you know, that's the lead, you know, and then you get to the certain threshold, you know, and I guess in performance sport, I think it should be the other side of 5%. I hate putting lines in the sand, but that's probably not a bad number. So then you get to the ones that are around 5% or less, and then you go, all right, keep. And now you've got your list. So you've got your first phase of deleting them was anything that was wildly inaccurate, right? So anything above, you put whatever number you want to this, right? Let's say 6%, 7%, whatever, gone. All right, now we're left with the others. All right, now these things are exactly the same, all right? These four measures are exactly the same. So which one do we keep? All right, well, first of all, which one's the most sensitive? Those two, right? Get rid of the other four. Great. Now, which one do we want out of these two? Which one relates best to the athlete? Which one, you know, that's just a choice at that stage. And as a group, you go, let's go that one. Fine. All right. Another group might go the other. It doesn't really matter. It's the same thing. And so that's how you get that process of elimination. And, you know, like the work that Dr. Angela Sorensen done on the weightlifting, right? There were 70 metrics she identified from weightlifting, all right, just in the pool. And it was like, crikey, that's a lot from the different phases. Now, which one are we going to take? There's no way we can report all 70 of these. Exactly the same process. Right, first level, what's wildly inaccurate, i.e. the variability is really high, i.e. the coefficient of error is high. Those ones, see ya. Next level, these are all the same, right? So which one correlates best back to the actual output? These ones, great. These ones, see you later. And then we're left with just a few. But again, to me, that's the skill of data analysis and how you apply it. You know, recognizing variability and not blindly including every metric that sounds like, because, you know, theoretically it has a link, it should work. A lot of them just, they're terrible. And they just muddy the water, and you can't program off them because they're so variable. You know, you might as well roll dice.
True. Anything else to add with data analysis? So, for example, we have 14 athletes and only 12 can make a team, or we have 7 athletes, 5 can go to a particular competition. How do we now decide how to choose, or how to compare between the athletes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends on the sport, but it's probably not a decision made on data. It's probably a decision made on skill of the athlete, right? So the coach will probably make that. It doesn't matter whether, you know, one athlete can jump 3 centimeters higher than the other, and the other physical capacity, you know, skill will always trump capacity, right? It's just that you take a skillful athlete and you give them a great capacity, the chances are they're a better athlete, right? But it's never going to take a good athlete, give them the physical capacity, and now they're a great, outstanding athlete, you know? So those decisions are still based on skill, but it might be, you know, maybe you would use that, for example, if there one person was coming back from an injury and then you had some comparative data to go, look, this person's still well off, you know, either their own previous data, if you had that, or the group average. And then at that point you go, look, I know that their skill is high, but physically they're not ready to go, you know? So every player needs to be a certain level of physical capacity to perform the task. And sometimes it matters if you keep going up, and sometimes it doesn't. As long as you're at that level, then skill can just progress past it. So Yeah, I think there's a few ways, which include not even using the data at all, basically.
All right, now let's go different scenario. So we have the data, we have an athlete. Now we have some variables going up and down. How do we decide which ones are the most important and should be worked on first, and which ones can wait? Because obviously we can't work on everything at the same time. So how to choose?
Well, look, the simplest way is choose the variables that are getting worse. You know, that's your low hanging fruit. There's no, you know, that's your got your biggest headroom for improvement. So you typically look at the athlete and go, these scores are lower than what they should be in terms of what the team are getting, or these ones have dropped off, target them ones. The exception to that is you might be in a particular block of training where you'd expect that drop off, you know, and that's fine. And you accept that and you just go, all right, well, it's working. You know, these other ones are going, it's working, let's keep going. And we accept that these ones are dropping off. So again, it's so context specific. It would be, you know, it would depend on the scenario, really.
Awesome.
And I think this is where the philosophical choice comes in, right? Which is crazy to mention that in the same breath as data analysis. But so my opinion, take the score, the best score, the average score, depends on the scenario. And we put one standard deviation either side of that. And we use that as our measure to detect where a true change is. Now, one standard deviation actually only represents about 68% of the variability. And what I mean by that, if our athletes jump 100 times, 68 of them would land within the interval that we have just described. Right. I could go two standard deviations and then I capture 95 of the jumps, or three standard deviations, I catch 99% of the jumps. Right. So my choice depends on whether I'm trying to avoid a type one or type two error in the data. So let me just explain what I mean by that. And if you look at typical research, it's about avoiding a type one error, which is a false positive. Right, where you claim something to be real when it isn't. It just happened through chance. And actually, that makes sense in the research, because in the research, let's say we're dealing with medicine and the consequences of being wrong could be fatal, you know, or cost millions and so on and so forth, affect the health and well-being of patients, right? You do not want to be wrong there. A type one error there is terrible. Now, if I go to a sports scenario, I mean, what's the worst that can happen really is that I continue with a program that isn't working as well as I thought it. Why, there is no real, it's unlikely to be fatal, let alone cause an injury or anything like that. Secondly, when you're working in sport, the top level, people who have been training for a while in terms of physical capacity are close to their ceiling, right? Let's assume. So there's not much headroom for improvement. So if I wait to say that a change is real, you know, and I want to be really confident, I need a big change. And that change might never happen in a really high athlete, which means we're overlooking these tiny marginal differences to a program that actually means something to an athlete. And so that's why I prefer one standard deviation, because it has a little bit of error. It counts for a bit of error, but not so much as I'm requiring the athlete to make these big changes just so I can be absolutely certain. I mean, if you look at the difference between any Olympic event, you know, and you know the finish times between the person that finishes first and the person that finishes eighth, no, there's no statistical significantly differences there. You know, there's no small changes. They're all trivial, right? But of course, that's an incredible difference. I mean, it's a life-changing difference.
Yes.
And so for me, I want to recognize the error, but I'm not afraid of the false positive. I think it's more important that I recognize things that might work than be confident I've not included something that doesn't. So that's my philosophical stance on it. But, you know, then I have to live by that choice. You know, it's a sword that you live and die by. So I can't flip between different metrics. That one I'm going with, or this scenario I'm going to go two standard deviations, that one I go one, or measure it later on. Let's change it back to one standard deviation, then we get a difference. Or that doesn't look right, let's put two standard deviations. This is the sword that I live and die by now. So, you know, I'm going to see some changes, but I accept I'm going to pick up things that don't necessarily mean anything. And that's the consequences that I have to deal with. But again, it's based on reasoned thought.
So your approach is to make a decision and live with the consequence and program accordingly. So you accept that the change you detected may not be real, and that's fine.
Exactly. But I'm going to detect tiny marginal changes, which I think is where high level sport is, right? If I go too conservative, I won't see those marginal changes. And that's the consequences that the type two error people live with, right? And I think in sport, you know, if you're dealing with newbie athletes or young athletes, fine, that's an okay approach to take, because I'm expecting big changes. And the top end, I'm not expecting big changes. changes. So I can't be putting myself in a situation where I might miss them. So yeah, that's the stance that I would take, and other people might argue differently, and that's absolutely fine.
Okay, two short questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift?
Favorite lift? Okay, for me doing it or for me watching an athlete?
You can choose which one you like and why.
I think the best lift for an athlete to be able to do would be the snatch, because firstly, the clean, you know, all of them are complex movements, which shows a good level of coordination. But because the snatch is overhead and you have to get into that position, what it says about the stability, the mobility is exceptional. If you get an athlete, even an athlete can just overhead squat, I think you tap your hands and you go, we can do a lot of good work here. And to me, that's the ticket to be able to do any exercise if an athlete can overhead squat. Where when they can't do that, you think, okay, we need to make some adjustments, or we need to some workarounds and build up to it. So for me, the overhead squat is the best lift. And obviously as part of the snatch, it also shows the coordination, the power and what have you, the stability to get into that position as well. So that would be the number one for me.
Yeah, that's beautifully said.
Yeah.
All right. Where people can find you if they want to follow your work or ask a question?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, Annex. Is at Anthony Turner UK, and I'm on ResearchGate as well, if you want to look up any of the research that me and my colleagues have done. And I've got a YouTube channel, which is also Anthony Turner UK, and on there you can see some of the videos that go through some of the data that we've talked about and so on.
Thank you so much, Anthony. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Pleasure for me as well. Thank you very much for the opportunity.